exists for nearly a century. The public interest is not served, but rather diminished by such staleness and stasis. Even the funniest jokes ever told are only so funny, by half, with each subsequent retelling. When you have already heard the same joke, or some predictable variation of it 50 times before, it is no longer just not funny. It is tiresome and tedious. The same applies to the tired tripe that America's imperial political class has been perpetually regurgitating on the American people for the last 50 years. Nothing is new, just refurbished for resale. But America sure could use a new set of jokes. Stone's rule number 70. Move to the right for the primary. Move to the center for the general. Obviously, the first part of the rule is stated for Republicans. If you are a Democrat, you move left for the primary. Whatever party you hail from, for the general election you move to, or at least towards, the center. This was Nixon's formulation. Secure a base first, then win the votes of independents and Democrats. The candidate who spends the entire campaign pandering to his base will win his base, but nothing else. Focusing on your base in the party primary is fine, but limit it to targeted communications, like direct mail. You want to motivate your base, but not offend independent and Democrat voters to whom you can appeal on other issues. If your base is 100% happy with your campaign, you are probably not getting any independent or Democratic votes. Donald Trump achieved in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania what John McCain and Mitt Romney could not. Trump made deep inroads into blue-collar working-class Democrat voters. Politics is about coalition building, holding your base while, at the same time, reaching out beyond it to win over every vote needed for ultimate electoral victory. Stone's rule number 71. Politics is the art of addition, not subtraction. John Davis Lodge, my mentor, was a congressman, governor of Connecticut, ambassador to Spain and Argentina, and both a Broadway and movie actor. Lodge taught me that politics is about adding to your coalition, and not alienating any voters unnecessarily. Often referred to as Henry Cabot Lodge's smarter brother, Lodge was broad-chested and handsome. He was also one of the greatest swordsmen of his day, betting Marlena Dietrich, Greta Garbo, and Myrna Loy. Charming and gregarious, Lodge married an Italian beauty who was working as a dancer. A Catholic, Francesca Bragiati Lodge was disdained by Lodge's Brahmin family, but was a huge asset with Italian voters, who were mostly Democrats in Connecticut. Francesca danced and sang in Italian at Lodge's campaign rallies to thunderous applause. Lodge defeated Colonel Henry Mucci, an Italian-American war hero, in a heavily Italian congressional district. Lodge understood that politics is the art of addition. Stone's rule number 72. Folks want to get government out of the boardroom and the bedroom. Elections are not won on the extremes. It is why Barry Goldwater and George McGovern both went down in flames. Elections are won by securing a base and then attracting independents and persuadable voters in the center. Ronald Reagan had a firm conservative base, but he won election with the votes of suburban moderates who correctly judged he was the right man at the right time. President Trump's campaign similarly brought voters of many stripes together, who were tired of Americans being put last by the Washington establishment. I believe that the America's governing majority will continue to be those who are fiscally conservative, anti-tax and pro-business, while at the same time socially moderate, with pro-choice, pro-privacy, and even pro-legalization of marijuana for any use, not just medicinal. The Gallup polling has indicated for the first time in history that a majority of Republican voters now support the legalization of marijuana, period. That is, not just medicinal marijuana. America's substantial block of voters who are fueled by the Internet and cable TV are neither Republican nor Democrat exclusively. And when they swing, they win elections. President Trump's supposedly impossible path to victory is proof of this, as well as a case in point. Stone's Rule Number 73. Pick a running mate who won't hurt you. After 30 years in Republican presidential politics, I can't think of any Republican vice presidential candidate who was impressive. The first rule in selecting a vice president is like the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. That's easier said than done. In 1960, Nixon chose the handsome but laconic Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. Lodge took a two-hour nap every afternoon and rarely campaigned on weekends. Lodge also surprised his running mate by declaring that Nixon would put a Negro in the cabinet. Nixon was forced to put out a quick statement, saying all cabinet members in a Nixon administration would be chosen on the basis of qualifications and merit, not color, lest he lose the southern states. George Bush chose Dan Quayle for vice president, for fear of being overshadowed by stronger potential candidates like Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. The VP nominee can't be bigger than the presidential candidate, and there were few on the political scene whose policy ideas were thinner than Bush's. Dick Cheney overshadowed George W. Bush and gave us a phony war to boot. No vice presidential candidate has pulled in a big, electoral vote-rich state since Lyndon Johnson pulled Texas out of the Kennedy column in 1960. And even then, it took widespread voter fraud and the wholesale destruction of absentee ballots before a recount could be mounted. Mike Pence helped shore up GOP's evangelical base for Donald Trump in 2016. The vice president has a lean and hungry look, as Shakespeare said of Macbeth. Make sure your glove fits. There was a day when no gentleman would leave the house without gloves and a hat. White or buff gloves in suede or chamois were required in fall, and pigskin and fur-lined leather gloves were best for winter. Today, your use of gloves will most likely be limited to the colder months. Choose gloves too large rather than too small. A man's hand looks foolish squeezed into a tight glove. Stone's Rule Number 74. Prepare for when the voters are paying attention. People in politics easily lose sight of the fact that the average person has exponentially less interest in politics and political issues than the average political junkie possesses. The distractions of everyday life, along with preoccupations like earning a living, paying bills, raising children, caring for family, and generally enjoying life in some form or another, make politics at best an intermittent feature of civic engagement, and at worst, a needless, fruitless annoyance, which only gets worse if ignored or left to its own devices. Most people only begin to focus on politics, if at all, in the few weeks just before an election. Nixon noted that voters pay attention to a candidate's announcement of their candidacy, their acceptance speech at the nomination convention, and their final election eve appeal, but little else, if anything, in between. The longer presidential nominating system, which forces candidates to run virtually nonstop for 2 years, may be of endless interest to political junkies. But most of the public is only vaguely aware that the process is ongoing, and that there has been some early jousting among the candidates. Because of this dynamic, any polling done early in an election contest is largely meaningless. In 2007, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani maintained a hefty lead in the polls among Republican voters. Within just a year, Giuliani had dropped to fourth place, and by the end of January 2008, he was out of the race entirely. As is the case with almost everything about his political forays, Donald Trump appears to be an exception. However, Trump's fame was so great, and his name recognition so high right from the start, that the conventional rules could not be applied as cleanly to the Donald. He had begun the race with the public already having interest in his candidacy, thanks to the many, many years he had devoted to marketing himself and the Trump brand in so many other arenas. Whatever the voter attention span may be, whatever the window of opportunity they may have to make their mark, great politicians like Jack Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, and Richard Nixon prepare meticulously for those key moments in a presidential campaign when most voters will be paying the most attention. Stone's rule number 75. Trust your pollster. A candidate who proceeds to run a multi-million dollar media budget to change public opinion without sophisticated polling is a loser. A great pollster may have an ideology, but they must divorce it from his or her analysis of raw polling data. That is never to say a poll should cause a candidate to change a heartfelt position. Rather, it is a question of emphasis and de-emphasis that must be examined. This ability to divorce your ideology from your analysis, and the ability to find consensus ideological issues, both strengthening your base and attracting undecided voters, is what makes a great pollster. Doug Schoen is in this mold. A one-time liberal Democratic candidate for Congress, Schoen is a giant among pollsters because of his ability to give you a cold, dispassionate reading of the numbers. Tony Fabrizio is another who has deep-seated conservative beliefs. But when it comes to issues, he knows which fights to pick and which to avoid. Dr. Richard Werthlin, a Mormon and closet polygamist, was Ronald Reagan's pollster, and always sugar-coated news to the Gipper. Bob Teeter, the Rockefeller to Bush liberal Republican pollster, was very bright, but risk-averse in a profession that requires risk. Pat Caddell was the last cowboy pollster who led where the numbers dictated, and first found the American thirst for reform, which led to the election of Donald Trump. A pollster can make or break a candidacy, without even appearing to do so. The subtleties can be infinite. While the process of polling may be scientific, the distillation and interpretation of the polling data is very much an art that is grounded in skill and talent. Stone's rule number 76. Do not fool your tailor. The same way you should trust your pollster, you should trust your tailor. An experienced tailor knows what you are up to. He has already cast a professional eye over your manly form. He knows that you cannot hold in your gut for more than a minute or two, and that your true waist will reassert itself while he is measuring you for trousers. Stone's rule number 77. Trousers must hang from the waist. The fluid line of a man's silhouette is the key to great tailoring. With a proper suit, the lines of the suit jacket skirt and the line of the trousers should be unbroken to the eye. Trousers should hang comfortably from the waist, rather than be cinched with a belt. That is why I prefer braces, which are called suspenders by Americans. In Britain, suspenders are garters meant to hold up socks, like Dagwood Bumstead. A fuller-cut trouser is often more flattering to the silhouette, and may help a great tailor like Mr. Chow, a master craftsman in New York of Chinese ancestry who trained on Savile Row. If you must wear a belt, it must be of the highest quality leather, and the buckle must be simple and non-ostentatious. No Confederate flags, no sports logos, no skull and crossbones, and no forget hell, the South will rise again artwork. I avoid recognizable designer house logos on belt buckles, although Hermes is acceptable if you live in Southern California, the south of France, or the Italian Riviera. Know if you dress right or dress left. Where do you hang your junk? A good custom tailor will ask when he makes suit trousers. A gentleman either hangs to the left or to the right, but one should know. Stone's rule number 78. The best candidate is one who's lost once. First-time candidates, if they're smart, are much more effective in their second bid for public office. Like Lincoln, Tom Keene Sr. lost bids for Congress and the governorship in New Jersey before winning over a 9-man field in the primary and snatching the governorship of the Garden State from Congressman Jim Florio. Running a losing effort teaches a candidate how the political system and the media work and prepare them to be a better candidate. Candidates who are afraid to lose are candy asses. Mario Cuomo would have never become governor if he didn't have the guts to run for mayor of New York City and lose. Chuck Percy wouldn't have won election to the U.S. Senate in 1966 if he hadn't run a losing campaign for governor of Illinois in 1964. Andrew Cuomo wouldn't be governor of New York today if he hadn't lost his 2002 run for the governorship and been elected attorney general. Losing sharpens a candidate's candidate skills. A candidate whose performance does not improve after losing will be a habitual loser. A candidate who bounces back from a first-race loss and returns to the field a more skilled candidate, hungry enough to put themselves through another campaign grind, is the next best thing to an incumbent running either for re-election or for another public office. Stone's Rules Part Number 5. How to Stay on Top. Stone's Rule Number 79. The higher you get on the flagpole, the more people can see your ass. This is one of the maxims of the late Arlen Specter, formerly counsel for the infamous Warren Commission, staunch proponent of the magic bullet theory, and longtime U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania. I agree with his saying, but not his conclusion of who killed JFK and why. Specter was one of the great survivors of American politics. Elected District Attorney of Philadelphia after bolting the Democratic Party and becoming a Republican, Specter was subsequently defeated in races for mayor, district attorney, governor, and U.S. Senator. In 1980, after never abandoning his commitment to public service and his dream of holding statewide office, Specter was elected to the U.S. Senate in that year's Reagan-led Republican tidal wave and went on to serve in the Senate for 30 years. In the U.S. Senate, Specter was a staunch defender of civil liberties, privacy, and free speech. After 9/11, Specter was one of the few who resisted the Bush administration's systematic efforts to create a police state. But Specter also sought to be smart about the war on terrorism. I slept better at night, knowing Arlen Specter was in the Senate. Specter's maxim is another way of saying that public exposure in politics cuts both ways. The more exposure you get, the greater the chance that what is exposed may not be your best face, but, instead, your ass. A political mistake is like a fart. Sometimes you have to just step away. Nixon once told me this, which is a blunt nugget of wisdom wrapped in a bit of toilet humor. I think it speaks for itself. Stone's Rule Number 80. Lay low, play dumb, keep moving. These were the rules of life for the late Lee Atwater, my former business partner, once Republican National Chairman, and a fellow mastermind behind George H.W. Bush's 1988 presidential campaign victory. Atwater's sage comes from the South Carolina experience. He was a master at keeping a secret and feeding you disinformation. Atwater even considered his best friends competitors. When he identified a true enemy in the internal infrastructure of the Reagan White House, or in the Bush campaign entourage, Atwater would flawlessly execute a plan to vanquish his enemies, who would be none the wiser than that Lee was their best friend. He rarely left fingerprints. The Atwater life rules are crucial for a young political operative who needs to avoid arousing the jealousy or ire of the old bulls. Stone's Rule Number 81. Admit nothing, deny everything, launch counterattack. These are my three corollaries to Lee Atwater's lay low, play dumb, and keep moving. Even though a warrior never goes on defense, quick denial of political charges against you must be placed on the record as part of your counterattack. Your supporters want to and must hear it, so it is necessary to rapidly rebut any charges before ramping up a counteroffensive. Never admit to anything. I am reminded of Joey Bishop in the movie Guide for the Married Man. Caught in bed with another woman by his wife, who demanded to know, "Who is that woman?" Without missing a beat, Bishop replied, "What woman?" Some are going to say I am employing this technique in dealing with the so-called Russian collusion matter. But the stone-cold reality of it is that the giant roiling smoke cloud of fake news insinuations implications, and loose charges of collusion between the Russians and Donald Trump or the Trump campaign, is itself, in fact, the ultimate dirty trick. It takes an expert like me to know one when he sees one, and rest assured, the radical left and their Democrat Party mouthpieces have pulled the dirtiest trick in modern American politics with this Russian collusion hoax that they have been cynically perpetrating on the American people for nearly 2 years, as of this writing. Dealing with this hoax on a daily basis only reminds me that the sooner you get off defense and onto the counterattack, the better off you will be. If you are on defense, you are losing. Stone's Rule Number 82. Politics is motion. At just 26, John P. Sears was a political aide to former Vice President Richard Nixon. Sears's understanding of how mass media works, particularly the political press from the 1960s to the 1980s, was brilliant. Attorney General John Mitchell drove Sears from the Nixon White House, but Sears went on to become Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign manager in both 1976 and 1980. Sears understood that a small group of media elites would cover a campaign based on a perception of whether the campaign was progressing or not. He also knew that a campaign, particularly the front runners, had to be proactive in making news that would generate voter interest, and thus movement among both the voters and the reporters trying to figure out how a candidate is doing. If a campaign is not dynamic, it is static. If a campaign is not on the move, it is floundering. Politics is kinetic. Politics is motion. Stone's Rule Number 83. Politics is also the perception of motion. The late Arthur Finkelstein was a heavy-hitter political consultant for conservative and Republican candidates around the country from the early 1970s until the early 2010s. Art was a genius at understanding free media and how it can create the perception of motion that is critical to a successful political campaign. Finkelstein was so perceptive about the electoral landscape in America that in 2004, nearly 4 years before Hillary Clinton's first failed presidential bid, and 12 years before her second, equally disastrous presidential campaign, that Art said of Clinton, "She will put off Democrats from the center. In terms of the Republicans, Hillary Clinton is a wonderful candidate for the presidency." Working with Finkelstein, I got a U.S. Senate candidate in the Iowa Republican primary to call for John Wayne's birthplace in Winterset, Iowa, to be made a national shrine and added to the National Register of Historic Places. Suddenly, an obscure former lieutenant governor running for the U.S. Senate was on the front pages of Iowa's newspapers and being featured on all of the network affiliates in every media market in the Hawkeye State. While politics is motion, a campaign is as much about the perception of motion, even where there may not be actual movement on some issue or another. To make the news, often you must create news. Stone's Rule Number 84. Hypocrisy is what gets you. New York Governor Eliot Spitzer's problem was not that he patronized high-priced call girls, but rather that he prosecuted numerous such escort services when he was Attorney General. Spitzer called for campaign finance reform after essentially taking $9 million under the table in illegal campaign loans from his billionaire father. In the end, it was hypocrisy that brought down Eliot Spitzer. Stone's Rule Number 85. Don't shoot the guy behind you. In politics, the hardest position to occupy is front runner in a race for public office. It is incumbent on the front runner to make news, show progress, and, above all, appear unconcerned about the challengers nipping at their heels. The most treacherous mistake for any front runner is also their greatest temptation, avoiding risk in order to maintain a lead. Campaigns are about capturing the interest of the voters and holding that interest. When a candidate has nothing new or specific to say, choosing to play it safe by saying little or nothing of interest, or nothing at all, voters will look elsewhere for scrappier, more vocal, more aggressive candidates who have something to say in their effort to gain ground. If you are not gaining votes, you are losing votes. But just as the front runner is expected to be the leading voice in any campaign, the front runner is also the central target. As the inevitable attacks start to flow, it is easier, or at least more tempting, for an already risk-averse front-runner to counterattack the trailing candidate or candidates, instead of having the discipline to stay on message and continue generating interest away from, not towards, an opponent's attacks. A candidate who attacks a trailing candidate forfeits front-runner status by doing so, and becomes just another one of the pack, fighting to secure a public office. The corollary to this rule would be, don't punch down. Attacking those trailing you, or of a lesser position on the political totem, only elevates them and increases their credibility. Stone's Rule Number 86. Greek-sparing gifts are probably trying to fuck you up the ass. When things seem too good to be true, it is because they are. People with schemes to make hundreds of millions of dollars for little effort on your part, in which they get you to use your strategic mind and guile in return for equity, are barking up the wrong tree. I once helped a company selling lottery products. I had a nice share of equity. Then I learned that the founder and CEO of this company, which would require scrutiny and approval by gaming regulators across the United States, was a convicted felon, who had embezzled more than $1 million from a previous employer to pay for an opulent lifestyle and a gambling habit. When I presented this information to other shareholders, I was asked to leave the company and sell my shares, and the CEO was given millions more in capital. The CEO couldn't get a contract with a public entity to save his life and burned through $6 million in seed capital, staying at the finest hotels, eating at the finest restaurants, leasing a mansion in Palm Beach, and leasing luxury cars for himself and his wife. The other shareholders were in love with his financial projections and couldn't see that they would never win a public contract with a convicted felon controlling the company. The CEO, rather than being prosecuted, was bought out of his stock for $9 million. The company has yet to make a dime, and the shareholders are SOL. Stone's Rule Number 87. Drop your voice. Don't shout. This is a rule that demented Democrat witch doctor Howard Dean should have learned. Hillary Clinton would have benefited from it too, though Clinton's voice is so naturally shrill and grating that probably no amount of vocal modulation could ever take the edge off of that auditory knife, which would cut its way through one's brain no matter what the volume. But I digress. Dropping your voice for emphasis is the best way to focus listeners on your key point. Reagan used this technique in his best speeches. Although as a trained actor, he knew when to bellow. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Nixon learned the technique from Roger Ailes and used it in his famous Train in the Night acceptance speech at the 1968 Republican Convention, in which he recounted his memories as a small boy listening to train whistles in the night and dreaming of far-off places. A masterful political orator can grip an audience with a near whisper, but any political speaker who has to shout has probably already lost the audience. Stone's Rule Number 88. Picture the picture. The Internet has truly supercharged the ability of almost anyone to flash a visual image around the globe literally in a matter of seconds. Before this ability became available to anyone with a computer and a connection to the World Wide Web, AP and UPI had the exclusive ability to reach millions through what were called wire photos. Subscribers to the wire services would instantly and simultaneously receive anything and everything that came over the wire, printed out on a giant continuously fed printer solely dedicated to this purpose. The system was very much a precursor to another revolutionary but transitional technology, the fax or facsimile machine. Mike Deaver, who choreographed Ronald Reagan's presidency, knew the value of image as captured in a split-second snapshot that all the world would see. Nixon understood this too. He and JFK were chatting amiably after their second debate in 1960, when an AP photographer approached. Nixon immediately began putting his finger in Kennedy's chest, like he was telling him off, just as Nixon had done to Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev in a famous photo from the so-called kitchen debate. The AP photo of Nixon appearing to face down Kennedy ran nationwide. JFK was furious, telling Arthur Schlesinger, "That man is a shit, a total shit." Ah, but Nixon was perceptive and quick-thinking enough to picture the picture that would soon be seen by millions. Stone's Rule Number 89. Don't dress above the voters. Candidates for public office should not dress significantly differently than the voters dress. When John F. Kennedy's brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, hastily joined the McGovern presidential ticket, when original VP nominee Tom Eagleton turned out to have been hooked up to jumper cables, he made his first campaign foray in custom designer Christian Dior French suits with high armholes and a continental cut, and extremely expensive Gucci loafers. Entering a working-class bar in Milwaukee to campaign, he looked like a Martian. A cheer went up when he shouted, "A round for the house," and the customers shouted for beer. Then he added, "And I'll have a Courvoisier," proving he was an asshole. John Kerry's Hermes neckties, not to mention his much-eared fondness for windsurfing, along with his lifestyle of the rich and famous, put him far apart from the average voter. It didn't help that the closest Kerry ever came to dressing like a regular American was in 1971, when he donned an olive drab fatigue jacket, to disdainfully testify to the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee that American fighting soldiers in Vietnam were worse than Genghis Khan. This is a Stone rule that, more than anything, comes down to something that seems to be disproportionately lacking amongst America's permanent political class: common sense. It also cuts both ways, with an implicitly corollary rule to not dress below your audience. Just as a candidate should not wear a crisp business suit and tie to a country fair, neither should that candidate show up to a gathering of business professionals in jeans and shirt sleeves. A candidate might have to attend numerous functions in any given day, each with a wildly different group of voters. Rushing from a business roundtable breakfast to a union hall lunch to a chicken and dumplings dinner at a rural volunteer fire company can make it a challenge to feel and look comfortable while dressing in a way that will also make voters feel comfortable with a candidate. Costume changes are neither possible nor desirable in the thick of back-to-back-to-back campaign stops, no matter how disparate the audiences may be. This would be an absurd waste of candidate and campaign time, and one screw-up in the event advance is all it would take to leave the candidate looking like a fool entering a room in garb grossly mismatched to the gathered voters. The solution is consistency in dress, with room for variation, from business casual to business formal. Whatever their dress, there is one thing above all that the candidate must maintain at all times: dignity. Stone's Rule Number 90. Always control the lighting. Marlene Dietrich and John F. Kennedy both understood this rule and exploited it to their every possible advantage. If you want to be seen in your best light, you must be seen in the best light. Never allow photographs, films, or speeches under fluorescent lights. Fat faces should be lit from above to minimize jowls. Nixon used this one. Know which side is your worst, and never be photographed from that side. Use backlighting when necessary. It's why you'll never find a bad photo of Lily Marlene. Stone's Rule Number 91. Don't be afraid to introduce people. After 10 national Republican presidential campaigns, my Rolodex is fat with contacts, movers and shakers in all 50 states. I know people who can help people who are friends. I never fear putting people who can help each other in touch. I don't reserve favors for myself, and I refuse to use the chit. The favor bank is, and should be, unlimited. Keeping score is stupid. unless you help someone who then refuses to help you in return, even once. Such people belong on a special list. Connecting allies is never a losing proposition. And though they may not see it immediately, your generosity, magnanimity, and political ubiquity will be remembered by your friends and respected by the rest. Stone's Rule Number 92. Politics is about the future, not the past. Politicians and their political strategists often have a self-destructive tendency to want to fight the last war. The best strategist learns from past experiences, but always recognizes that no two campaigns are ever alike, because no two sets of election circumstances are ever alike. Superficially, the nuts and bolts of any political campaign will appear roughly the same as every other campaign you have seen. If the rote mechanics of a campaign made any significant difference, there would be no need for a superior strategy, deft maneuvering, or the constant inventive creativity that are what transform a credible effort into a victorious campaign. Apply the lessons of the past to realities of the battle at hand, but don't try to impose them if they don't fit the situation. What worked in the past won't necessarily work now. Politics demands innovation and reinvention because it is a constantly evolving landscape. You have to keep the voters interested, but also perpetually refine your ability to best your competitors, who are also evolving and refining their skills with every new battle. The voters themselves are always looking forward. Americans are amazingly resilient, and though we are affected by the past, we are more concerned with the future and the possibilities it holds. Stone's Rule Number 93. Reinvent yourself. When the voters reject the image of you being presented to them, reinvent yourself. Bill Clinton was a master of this. So was Richard Nixon. All through the 1950s and 1960s, as both vice president and presidential candidate, Nixon signed autographs, correspondence, and all but the most formal documents as Dick Nixon. In 1962, while running for governor, his campaign pamphlets included Dick Nixon's 12-point plan for California progress. 1966 saw the death of Dick Nixon and the rise of Richard M. Nixon. Gone were Dick Nixon the red-baiter and Dick Nixon the partisan slasher. Tricky Dick had disappeared. And in his place was now Richard M. Nixon, seasoned, experienced, and a man who had time to reflect on the great issues of the day. Nixon literally stopped signing his name as Dick Nixon, and now signed his name as Richard M. Nixon. Research into the online market for Nixon autographs would show that the dogged political phoenix's autographs ceased being Dick Nixon after his metamorphosis. It was with the Richard M. Nixon persona that Nixon staged one of his many odds-defying political comebacks, winning the presidency in 1968. Just 8 years after losing his first bid for it, by the smallest margin in history, to Senator John F. Kennedy. Just as there was no longer a Dick Nixon after 1966, so too disappeared Senator Jack Kennedy in January of 1961. In politics, the old aphorism about perseverance is slightly modified. If at first you don't succeed, try, just don't try the same thing again. Stone's Rules, Part Number 6. Cashing in. Sex, money, and notoriety. Stone's Rule Number 94. Nothing is on the level. Flamboyant New York attorney Roy M. Cohn, the notorious right-hand man to Senator Joseph McCarthy and a Reagan confidant, told his mob godfather client Joseph Fat Tony Salerno that nothing is on the level. Everything can be fixed. Just costs money. The U.S. Supreme Court? Fat Tony asked. Costs a few dollars more, Cohn replied. Stone's Rule Number 95. Don't tell me the case. Tell me the judge. Politics permeates everything. Only a dope would think otherwise. Judges are public servants who may not have won an election race. Elected judges are more rare in America than those appointed to the bench. But they have nonetheless succeeded in the political process. Some judges are fair and honest. Others are on the take, or taken with their own power. The absolute authority a judge unilaterally wields, from behind black robes on a high perch overlooking their fiefdom, hardly lends itself to greater humility, or frankly, humanity. The complexity and the sheer volume of all of the laws on the books, from federal down to municipal, rather than creating precision and definition in dispensing justice, only allows greater room for judges to be arbitrary and capricious. This is why Roy Cohn used to say, "Don't tell me the case, tell me the judge." Stone's Rule Number 96. There is only one party, the party of green. This is the real thing that ideologues and novices fail to understand. In Washington, D.C., the Republicans and Democrats at the congressional level, even with lessened civility, still answer to the same special interests like Goldman Sachs, the House of Saud, Big Oil, Big Hollywood, Big Pharma, the hedge funds, and other robber barons. It was California Speaker Jesse Big Daddy Onrue who said, "Money is the mother's milk of politics." In the end, money greases everything. Money in campaign contributions, money financing nonprofits, money in public relations campaigns, but also, most importantly, money for re-election. Until you get the money out of politics, which, let's face it, will never happen. Unless there is quite literally free media advertising, not public financing, given to candidates, this will not change. Whatever their party affiliation, they are all in the party of green, driven by the need to get the green to win another term. Stone's Rule Number 97. Money is like manure on a farm. No good if you don't spread it around. When guys grease me, I have to grease a small army of gunsels, operatives, spies, informants, lawyers, web designers, graphic artists, researchers, and the young army of people who work with me. Young people especially depend on prompt full payment of their compensation, so they can pay their rents, mortgages, put gas in their cars, and buy groceries. Delays in cash flow hurt these working people and cannot be tolerated. Pay your bills, and pay them on time. If you order a political assassination, pay for it. Stone's Rule Number 98. Overtip. Stinginess is the worst of sins. A man who does not overtip is a piker. A waiter, doorman, grocery bagger, or cab driver busts their ass to make less in a day than you spend for lunch. The cost of your cigars is greater than what they make an hour. I've worked for tips during the summers in Connecticut. Not an easy way to make ends meet. Bad tipping is a sign of a lack of true success and financial and social comfort. Even if you don't have it, tip like you do. My friend Marvin Liebman, former communist, Israeli terrorist, London producer, and Catholic convert, always said, "The one time you must go first class is when you're broke." Stone's Rule Number 99. Never pass up the opportunity to have sex or be on television. I have lifted this from Gore Vidal, who is right on both scores. Stone's Rule Number 100. Let's talk about sex, baby. Sex is an intensely personal thing. Voters don't care about sex, as long as it's between consensual adults. I always thought it was stupid of Republicans to try to impeach Bill Clinton over an Oval Office blowjob, where they could have impeached him for selling nuclear secrets to the Chinese. I have always been a libertine, and have never made any bones about it. I find it amusing when left-wing websites accuse me of being in league with the religious right in promoting their agenda in the 1980s. Nothing could be further from the truth. Once asked by a reporter about my own sexuality, I said I was a trisexual, I've tried everything. Trust me, I got more than my share during the summer of love. I have long said and written that the evangelical Christian insistence on opposition to gay marriage and legal abortion would destroy the Republican Party by costing us any chance with younger voters. Stone's Rule Number 101. Pizza is like sex. Even when it's bad, it's still pretty good. Good pizza is the slice you can find at 3 a.m. when you are smashed or high after a night of revelry. Beyond that, pizza is a very personal thing. The style of pizza in my native Connecticut is a thin coal oven charred pie with sausage or their garlicky white clam pizza. The people in Chicago like a deep dish pizza that is mostly bread. I once caught Frank Morano, a New York radio personality and political activist, ordering this deep dish style pie from a joint near his radio station, which almost got him banished from his native Staten Island once it was learned, Staten Island being a citadel of great pizza. A thin, well-charred Neapolitan pizza is the ideal breakfast with a triple espresso, as far as I'm concerned. Generally speaking, however, you should always avoid any pizzeria called Ray's or Ray's Original. Also avoid pizza places called John's, with the exception of John's of Bleecker Street in the West Village. This is a shrine to great pizza. When I was growing up in industrial Norwalk, Connecticut, a short bicycle ride from where I lived was a full-service Italian restaurant owned by a retired prizefighter named Phil Baker, a lightweight whose real name was Philip J. Matro. Baker turned out a phenomenal pizza, topped with fennel-laced Italian sausage. The distinct aroma and wonderfully unique taste of Phil Baker's pizza pies sticks with me to this day. When the state of Connecticut decided to finish construction on Route 7, the restaurant was razed to make way for Progress. I spent the rest of my life looking for any pizza that could match this boyhood ideal. Stone's Rule Number 102. Size does matter. It still amazes me when I see commercial or political graphics in which the key message is not printed boldly and in the largest possible type size. Voters observe political information in little more than a quick scan. According to David Ogilvie, the legendary advertising genius, billboards, which I disdain, need no more than 6 words to be effective. Size also matters in the boudoir. Don't let anyone tell you differently. Guys who brag about their oral technique have small dicks. Stone's Rule Number 103. Never ride in a white limousine. Limousines themselves should be off-limits for candidates seeking public office. This is not to be confused with the limousine service that comes with being elected governor, president, or to the leadership of Congress. Those are the perks of office, and should be used in the governmental capacity. I once worked for a Republican candidate for Attorney General of Virginia, who showed up at a GOP rally in a vintage Rolls-Royce limo that belonged to a wealthy Republican supporter. The AP wire photo made the front page of a daily newspaper the next day, whereupon his opponent branded him the Rolls-Royce candidate of the wealthy. White limousines are particularly gauche. Their use should be limited to strip clubs and pimps. Stone's Rule Number 104. Ethnic traits are what they are. Whoever said you should speak German to your dog, French to your horse, Italian to your priest, Spanish to your mistress, and English to your wife, almost had it right. The Italians have a style that is sometimes impractical. There is nothing more beautiful than the lines of a classic Alfa Romeo or a 1960s vintage Ferrari, but neither is likely to start on a reliable basis. The real trade-off in life is figuring out how to balance form and function. I'm sure that a boxy, cookie-cutter Lexus sedan is as reliable as the day is long, but I will never drive anything so nondescript and generic. When I lived and worked in Washington, D.C., I drove a 1972 Citroën DS21 Palace sedan, and a 1970 Citroën DS Familiale Break, the station wagon model. I switched to Jaguars in the late 1970s, when parts and service for the Citroëns became scarce. Jaguars had a reputation for both beauty and unreliability. But this is only true of Jaguars made before Ford Motor Company acquired the British car maker in 2000. Jaguars remain stylish and sexy. Yes, if you have an older model, it might break down, but you'll still look good next to it, waiting for roadside service. Stone's Rule Number 105. Be blasé in the face of celebrity. People who gush when they meet, or are in the presence of a celebrity, show their weakness, lack of sophistication, and lack of social status. On top of this, it is just really uncool. One must be blasé, even vaguely detached and indifferent, to the fact that you are in the presence of a superstar. When I met Madonna at a South Beach cocktail party in the early 1990s, I asked her what she did for a living. Stone's Rule Number 106. Cufflinks should be understated, small and elegant. Large ostentatious cufflinks are for New Jersey Mafia dons, Las Vegas lounge singers, and Harlem pimps, if there are any left. Cufflinks should be understated, small and elegant. Enamel, gold or silver are fine, but never large and brassy. And big stones of any kind, verboten. No coffee grinders, no giant gold coins, no jet planes, and no faux gems. Buy a pair of black and a pair of blue silk knots. Put them in the ticket pocket of your suits when traveling. They go with everything and can sub for a missing cufflink in a pinch. Stone's Rule Number 107. Cuff length, up to you, but show some. A gentleman needs to show linen at the end of the sleeve of a well-cut suit or sports jacket. How much you show is up to you. I recommend at least an inch and a half for Americans. For myself, I prefer the English and Italian style of 2 inches. This is just as true with button cuffs as it is with turn-back cuffs, which the uneducated call French cuffs, although no one can find any particular connection to those garlic-smelling frogs. Stone's Rule Number 108. 2-inch cuffs. The American norm is 1.5 inches. 2 inches makes you look taller and weight the cuff so it hangs properly. Look at a photo of Prince Philip in a suit made for him by his longtime tailor, Poole of London. That's what a gentleman's trouser should look like. 2-inch cuffs. Stone's Rule Number 109. Monograms. The notion of marking your possessions with an artful logo of your initials was a popular style in the 1920s and 1930s. A gentleman had his initials painted on his Louis Vuitton luggage and, discreetly, on the driver's door of his Packard convertible cruiser. Today, monograms are a bit trickier. Put them on the cuff of a button-down shirt, and you mark yourself a salesman from Toledo. Monograms are for shirt fronts only, exactly 1 inch below the left nipple. Breast shirt pockets are a mistake, unless you are a nerd. A dress shirt is pocketless. The monogram should be small, discreet, and understated. Avoid excess. An excess of jewelry should always be avoided, but the gentleman may wear gold or silver cufflinks and a watch chain if he favors a pocket watch. He may also wear a flower in his buttonhole, for this is one of the few allowable devices by which he may brighten up his attire without being garish. Stone's Rule Number 110. A word about jewelry. Don't. This is an area where less is more. Necklaces or chains are for South Philly Guidos. ID bracelets are for the outer boroughs. Keep it minimal. A tasteful family crest ring is fine. Make a crest up like Trump did, if you don't have one. A wedding ring if you're hitched. And a slim, tasteful watch that does not weigh 3 pounds is also okay. I have some woven bracelets for my granddaughters. I love these and wear them daily. Stone's Rule Number 111. The Brooks Brothers style white, all-cotton button-down collar shirt is an indispensable element of every gentleman's wardrobe. Bill Buckley wore his with a black bow tie and cummerbund with a tuxedo. Gianni Agnelli fastened his wristwatch over the cuff of his and never buttoned the collar down. Looks great with sleeves rolled up, with a ribbon belt and khakis. Goes with every conceivable color and pattern of sports coat or suit, except double-breasted. In pink or light blue with a Madras jacket, it's perfect for summer. Paired with a herringbone sports jacket and a black knit tie, it's perfect for fall and winter. These days, the best one is made by Kamakura, a Japanese company. After changing hands and factories so many times, venerable old Brooks Brothers has lost the proper role of the collar. Kamakura has it, and the price is right. Throw a folded one in your travel bag. It goes with everything. Stone's Rule Number 112. Too much of a good thing is about right. Donald Trump's election victory shows, among many other things, that media have become so diverse that there is no such thing as overexposure. In any election campaign, especially a national race, name recognition is a basic and often expensive goal. Trump's years of marketing himself made that irrelevant in his presidential bid. His taste is not mine, except Mar-a-Lago, his Palm Beach club/mansion, which he restored meticulously to its 1920s grandeur using a team of the finest artisans. You can find the Trump name on games, coffee mugs, T-shirts, bottled water, vodka, cologne, men's suits, and extra-large condoms. And they all sell. He is a marketing genius. What other Manhattan real estate mogul was an internationally known figure? Zeckendorf? There is only one. And now he is the President of the United States. That is not luck, my friends. That is drive, determination, and pure genius. Period. Stone's Rule Number 113. When your candidate tells you your TV spot is on too heavily, and people are complaining about seeing it too much, you are just starting to permeate the public consciousness. Media have come a long way from the day we had three major networks and some powerful local independent TV stations. Then, viewers were limited to the 13 channels on the dial. Some of those channels had snow, because not enough programming was available, or operating a channel would not be economically feasible. A small broadcast monopoly existed. Today, when media are diverse, with hundreds of cable news networks, talk radio, blogs, websites, radio stations, and broad use of the Internet, it takes focused and expensive repetitive efforts to punch through an idea to the voters in an atmosphere where they are constantly bombarded with a cornucopia of information. To punch through a message in this din, put up one kick-ass TV spot and pile up the repetitions, being careful to place time on the proper cable news networks to reach conservatives, women, Democrats, older men, and other target voter groups that your polling tells you are susceptible to your message. This takes repetition and discipline to load up enough GRPs behind the spot to punch through. Stone's Rules, Part Number 7. Roger's Rules for Survival. Stone's Rule Number 114. Cock your hat. Angles are attitudes. Frank Sinatra nailed this one. It's about the angle of your Homburg. It's about the knot and your silk Italian scarf. It's about the right shoes with the right stovepipe leg jeans. It's about your pocket square of a paisley silk and a white linen monogrammed handkerchief you carry at all times, folded in a pocket. It's about the piece of thread that a Savile Row tailor sews into the back of the buttonhole in your lapel, in order to hold the stem of a flower of boutonniere, just so. It's about the ticket pocket on the jacket, the 2-inch waistband on the full-cut reverse pleated trouser with 2-inch cuffs. It's about black silk knotted cufflinks, which work in a pinch with everything. It's about carefully tying your formal bow tie ever slightly and perfectly, so everyone will know you actually tied it yourself. It's about knowing what you look good in and wearing it. It's about developing a uniform in which you know you look your best, but also recognizing that to break the rules, you must